Happy New Year, everyone, and welcome to 2021. This is your host, as always, Jorge Luis Quintero, and welcome to Quintero o Dinero. In today's episode, our special guest today is Judge Rosie Spielin Gonzalez. Judge Rosie Spielin Gonzalez resides over Bexar County Courtroom Number 13 for San Antonio, Texas, and those cases involve domestic violence. And for those of you that don't know, domestic violence is a serious issue, not just in San Antonio. It's big in Texas, but worldwide. Pay attention to what's going on in your home, in your environment, within your neighborhood. You know, be close to your neighbors. That's important. And that's what Judge Rosie Spielin Gonzalez is aiming to do, is better humans. She recently drafted the Reflejo Court Bill that was passed, which is looking to sharpen first-time offenders for domestic violence. She also served as an attorney for child welfare for 17 years. And before that, she was a social worker working for CPS for 11 years. So she's played the whole ball field. She has seen it all, from children to adults, families. She's also teaching a course in at UTSA with her wife, Stacy Spielin Gonzalez, teaching child abuse and domestic violence at the University of Texas at San Antonio, UTSA. Go Cardzo. Well, I don't want to spoil too much. I enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you guys enjoyed just as much as I did. Ladies and gentlemen, let's bring out Judge Rosie Spielin Gonzalez. Salute.
Salute.
Thank you so much for doing this podcast.
You're very welcome.
I understand that for you being a judge, you took two attempts, right? And then on the third attempt?
That's correct.
For Bexar County Court 13?
Court 13. It's a county court at law that hears misdemeanor cases that reflect exclusively alleged crimes of domestic violence. So I'll give you some examples. Assault bodily injury, assault causing a bodily injury in a married, or I would say intimate relationship, romantic relationship, married, right? And then there's assault bodily injury, family or household member. That could be as between a parent and an adult child. That could be as between siblings. They have to live in the same household to be charged with that. There's unlawful restraint. You can't hold somebody against their will anywhere. And if you do that, you get charged. And if you're in a romantic relationship, and you know of arguments where someone said, they won't let me out the door, you know, or you've seen it happen, or you've been party to it one way or another. Grabbing someone's phone when someone's attempting to call 911, that's interference with an emergency call. That's also considered, depending on the nature of the relationship, domestic violence. Terroristic threats. You can't say something to someone, threaten their safety, wanting to put them in fear of something you may or even may not mean to do, have no plan on doing it, but you made the threat. So terroristic threat, violations of protective orders, deadly conduct, all if they're having to do with a familial member or someone you live with or someone you're romantically involved with, intimately involved with, falls under domestic violence. And we hear class A misdemeanor domestic violence cases. So that is the highest level of a misdemeanor charge, most severe, most serious. The range of punishment for that type of offense is up to 365 days of incarceration at the Bexar County Jail. In addition to that, a court can impose and assess up to $4,000 in fines. And specifically for assault bodily injury, and there's a couple of other more on that list that I just ticked off to you, the court can restrict, even strip you of your Second Amendment right to ever use firearms or guns again in your life. You will not be able to possess, purchase, own, or use a firearm for the rest of your life. And that's under the affirmative finding of family violence. And so that's often done in our court. That's the kind of court that I preside over at this time.
And what made you want to get involved with domestic violence?
Out of college, I went to St. Mary's, got my undergrad there in political science, but stumbled into, basically, when I was in graduate school, working at an incredible facility to this day. I think they did some great work with some very troubled youth and young people, but it was the Southwest Neuropsychiatric Institute for Children. And it was located where the children's shelter is located right now at St. Cloud and Woodlawn. And they had, four or five different cottages with different levels of care for different ages of kids. And they all live there. And I happen to work on the admissions unit. So that's where I started my journey in the field of working with kids and in the field of social work. From there, I was an investigator and at Child Protective Services and was part of a pilot program there and also did family reunification services. Worked at communities and schools as a gang counseling facilitator, specifically with self-identifying gang members back in the early 90s at Harlandale High School, and also worked at the Mexican-American American Unity Council as a program director for a program for at-risk youth who had a first-time contact with juvenile authorities and also had self-disclosed some experimentation with drugs. So it was a prevention type of intervention program for adolescents. And we worked closely with the juvenile court and the truancy courts to get these kids into a 12-unit program that, if they completed successfully, would result in their case being dismissed. And it was a life skills type of course that we taught there. I then went on to move to Travis County, where I had got hired as a probation officer, juvenile probation officer, specifically working on diversion programs. When I first started there, I went on to work in the ISP or intensive supervision and gang unit, did several specialized caseloads, sex offenders, all adolescent, all children offenders, felony offenders, Spanish speaking offenders. So, you know, did a lot of work there and then came to Brownsville and ended up at my old high school, taught there for about, I was just there one school year. And during that time, my mom asked that I consider applying to law school. It was a thought when I had first graduated from college, but I didn't have the discipline at that time to be in law school. So at 33, I returned to law school, came here to St. Mary's, got my law degree, took the bar several times and passed it and went straight into solo practice. And then that started the next 16, 17 years of solo practice and started out as a general practice. But that experience, it was 11 years before I went back to law school. When I graduated from law school and got my license, I started the general practice and then I was pulled to the areas that were familiar to me. Mm-hmm. The child abuse docket, that was familiar to me. I had gone to court as a caseworker. The juvenile courts, I had gone to court as a probation officer. I did the mental health court down at the state hospital. That was familiar to me because I worked in an environment where people's capacity was deficient in either emotionally or cognitively. And so that's where I ended up getting drawn to. I represented defendants in the domestic violence courts. I did family law. I did child abuse cases. I did mental health. And it drew me to the areas of that, like family law. And that's how it all came to come into shape into how I ended up being the type of advocate that I was. And that's representing a whole lot of families in child protective services cases, a whole lot of foster kids, getting board certified by the National Association of Counsel for Children as a child welfare law specialist. And so, you know, that's kind of a long way around the block to get to the answer to that one, right?
No, that's fine. I mean, it seems like throughout all of your experiences in life, it was like your path to be like a judge, just like so much that you've seen. And I'm pretty sure you have such a soft spot for kids and everything.
Well, you as a young person at your age, how old are you?
24.
So at about 26, 27, I was working a lot, and maybe it was about 27, 28, but in my journey to Austin, I remember just sitting and just wondering, is this as good as it gets? You know, I've worked for my degree, and in Austin, I remember a couple years back to back, I worked like five jobs. I was a probation officer during the day. I worked at a girls' residential facility at night. I worked at a mother-child rehab residential facility on the weekends. I called basketball games for UIL. That's four. And in that given year, I remember when I did my taxes, and it happened like 2 years back to back. I couldn't break like the $37,000, $38,000 a year, even putting all that together, right? And I'm just like, God, I'm working so hard, you know? And I always remember my mom's like, you got to work smarter, not harder. And she saw that kind of potential in me, and that she pushed me to go to, you know, to apply to go to law school. But it's just the whole experience, if I'm telling you now, you know, at your age, I was already like, it's got to get better than this. You know, I have to find my calling of some sort because I felt like I was spinning my wheels, you know? And now when I look back at it, you know, they do that little exercise. What would you tell your 18-year-old self? What would you tell yourself if you were talking to your 25-year-old self? And so for me, at 55, I look back and I'm like, everything that I went through in my 20s at whatever job prepared me to be the type of lawyer that I was 20 years later. I drew on those experiences. And for me, that's kind of serendipitous. You know, I see some sort of plan there for me. Stuff like that just doesn't happen. And I think if you're open to the possibilities as you weave through that journey, you know, you can have unlimited potential to be successful in like all sorts of different areas.
Well, with the work you did, it sounds like your emotions were all over the place.
They could be. As a worker at CPS, there was a child death of a 5-year-old that affected me profoundly. There was a death of an infant where specifically it was one in that pilot program where we did everything by the book. And it was the first time that I took photographs of healthy children, what we believe to be healthy children, because it was such a horrendous referral of bite marks and bruises and cigarette burns and just on and on. And I get to where the children are with their mother, and the mother says, check them. Our high-tech unit at the time had just been given one-step Polaroids to take photographs. Yeah. And we all had pagers, and we shared a banana phone when we were responding to priority ones. And banana phones weigh like a brick. That was our high-tech unit. So at that time, when the baby had two siblings, I took the photographs. I took them to my supervisor. Her name was Sherry Gomez. You know, she reviewed all my notes. We went over and I said, the lady wants to leave to Dallas. She says the baby's father's working in Dallas. Can she leave? The decision is made that we will say, yeah, I mean, we don't have any reason to keep her here. There's no proof of any abuse that we could see. And she leaves, and the only criteria that we demand of her is that when she gets to Dallas, because she's such a young mom with two kids and in a new place, that we're going to set her up with a family-based type of social worker just on risk because she's moving. We don't want her to just stress out. Can she please call Monday when she, you know, settles in, because she was going up there. She had bus tickets for the kids and herself, and they leave on a Friday, I think, or Thursday. And sometime between the time they leave, they get to Dallas, and she and the father of the kids get into an argument. They're living with his people, his family. They're staying in an apartment of some sort or house. And he leaves to work. And the way that it's reported, the relatives could hear the infant crying nonstop into the night, into the next day, into the next day. At some point on Sunday, because she won't allow anybody to go into the bedroom where the baby is. At some point Sunday night, somebody's able to get past her into the bedroom, and the baby's wrapped in just swaths of clothing. And it's discovered that the baby is burnt. The story of, I'm going to tell you right now, you need to be aware that this is a very graphic description of what happened. You know, make sure you're okay with any trauma. The mother admitted that after she got in an argument with his father, she took the baby by the heels and she had a pot of boiling water on the stove and she dipped the baby all the way down. So the baby was going to be deaf and blind and was going to need multiple skin grafts throughout their life. I want to say within a week, the baby died. So CPS rushes in on that woman and the baby. The two other babies, they discovered multiple healing fractures. Wow. Okay. And so, of course, that affects you. Why does this happen? And do you blame yourself? Do you blame a God of your understanding? You know, whose fault is it that something like this happens? When everything on a checklist is checked off. Maida, your aunt, can share with you what we know has happened in our county. You know, there's been at least two or three cases that have gotten a lot of publicity where all the boxes were checked off. You know, the parents did everything they're supposed to do. There's evidence put on to the judge that they're doing extremely well, that they're transitioning well into the new house, that they've got a support system out there. And 2 weeks later, you have a dead baby on your hands. What happened? So we work with the population that's, you know, many times unpredictable. When you mix mental health with substance abuse, and then the behaviors that stem from both those issues, which is usually violent behavior, dangerous behavior, reckless behavior, negligent behavior, then you have the perfect storm for what we have to deal with in domestic violence court and CPS courts.
So with domestic abuse and child abuse, is there a big correlation with mental illness and drugs involved?
I don't know about a big correlation. I think what we see anecdotally is that if someone is suffering and is inflicted with some sort of a psychological disorder or even a personality disorder, and their only relief from the disorder may manifest as anxiety or depression, mm-hmm, or anger or self-loathing or some debilitating level of shame, then usually the go-to is to some altered state of mind. Mm-hmm. And how do you get there? Well, you can start with smoking a cigarette, maybe a joint. Maybe you get into your parents' liquor cabinet or your dad's beer. And as a young person, you know, it doesn't take much to alter your mind, but you find that you like that. And it takes away all those inhibitions. And so then it becomes this sort of behavior that is cyclical. And it just gets worse and worse, and the addiction gets worse, and your shame gets deeper, and your depression gets deeper, and you get into the cycle, and you become non-functional.
So earlier you said, whose fault is it? You know, when everything's done by the book, if you were to pinpoint whose fault it is, what could you brainstorm and see what the fault is?
I don't know that it would be fault, but I think you could take a thread and start with the two points. The female's point, maybe, you know, this is a person whose reaction was based in trauma. She was so fearful of, you know, either being abandoned or being neglected or being shunned. We don't know what happened during that argument, but it set her off. Who knows what he said to her? Yes, he wasn't there, but maybe he touched her. Maybe he pushed her. Maybe he threatened her. We don't know. For her, who, you know, we're talking someone maybe like Andrea Yates, right? What set her off? You know, she drowned her children, you know, while her husband was at work and heard voices telling her to do so. You know, I don't know that this woman didn't hear voices. Once it got turned over to the criminal authorities up in the Dallas area, they didn't need me to testify. You know, all they needed was government records to prove up in Dallas. And
what's a good solution to help with mental illness? Because people are always talking about mental illness. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's becoming a big problem nowadays. And we're kind of like hiding away from it.
I think it's always, deviant behaviors have always existed.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
There's always been depression. There's always been violence. There's always been anxiety. There's always, you know, been some sort of, as they say in Spanish, human vicio, right? An addiction to something. And so as we have put more and more data, you know, collected more and more information, we put labels on things. I think education on where these behaviors are rooted in, on anxiety, on anger, on what trauma can do to not only an adult, but even more profoundly to children when it goes unaddressed. And when a child watches on a daily basis their parents get violent with each other, their parents screaming at each other, maybe choking each other, maybe raping each other, maybe just slapping around, and I shouldn't word this just, but maybe slapping around. We don't know the extent to which some of these children are exposed to violence within their own homes where they're supposed to feel safe. And in most cases, the very parents whose behavior is damaging their children, are they themselves adult survivors of domestic violence acts against them? It's a very cyclical behavior pattern amongst our society. And if we don't nip it in the bud when children are young, if we don't nip it in the bud and try to upstream address the trauma of the abuser, then all the punishment in the world is not going to fix that abuser. They'll go on to other people and abuse those other people as well. But if you address the trauma with the abuser, you have some hope and some data that shows that, and that behavior can change with the right support systems and the right type of therapy. And it's like a psychotherapy and the right type of programming. And we have that. We have that in our court. It's called the Reflejo Court. That specialty court is for violent offenders. No one wants to fund violent offenders. It's not the sexy, politically correct thing to do, help violent offenders. But from a financial standpoint, I think it's fiscally more responsible to try to change the core of the behavior than to watch the survivor needs grow more and more. And we've seen an uptick in cases being filed, not only because of COVID, but just because of population growth and the lack of awareness of this type of crime that exists in our community. But if you address the behavior at the very core and you work with the perpetrator, then the flow downstream won't be a tidal wave. We want to make that a trickle, you know, a small stream, a creek. Right now we're at tidal wave status. And the only way is to tighten it up here. And we tighten up by working with the perpetrator. And we have programs like Mission Possible 360. That's a curriculum specifically designed for violent offenders with a substance abuse problem. We have the participants engaged in trauma therapy. They go to AA meetings. They have individual counseling. So they have a variety of programs that and phases they have to go through to show that they're committed to changing their behavior. We provide aftercare support. And the carrot at the end of this program is that their case is dismissed. I think the one thing I did not mention is that it must be a first-time offense of domestic violence for them to qualify.
Yeah. Okay. So the funding, where is it going to?
Well, we have infrastructure, okay? It's going to a case manager salary, her training. It's going to pay for trauma therapy. It's going to pay for the MP360 instructors and the time they take to teach the participants what they need to teach in regard to their trauma and how to better improve their way in which they approach life. It pays for treatment. Now, each of these participants, as part of their contract to participate in the Reflejo Court, have to pay out of their pocket $1,000 in fees by the end of the program. So it's not all directly coming out of a taxpayer pot. These participants are court ordered to, and within the time that they work their program, have to pay off $1,000 in the program fee.
Okay. And now these offenders that are involved in domestic violence, how are they financially as far as like... As a demographics, how's all that?
I think what you see is that domestic violence cuts across every income level.
Every income level.
Now, anecdotally, what I can share with you from this side of the bench is that it appears to me that there is a higher number of individuals that are unemployed or are between jobs, work for temp services. And so we do have individuals that are retired, individuals that, you know, have their own business. We have folks that are in law enforcement. So you have of every race, of every gender, of every creed, of every group, they come through as defendants in these courts. The act itself is blind to your education level, to your income level, to your gender. It happens to men and women of every income level, of every education level, of every culture, nationality, ethnicity.
So it's just all humans.
Pretty much. Okay. You know, it is a behavior that is about control.
Okay.
And it's about one human's need to control another human. Because it happens among heterosexuals, homosexuals, bisexuals, transgender individuals. So
it's everybody.
A control issue. Yes. Okay.
So one thing you said about earlier is the education. I mean, I'm in college right now and I don't think I've ever taken a course about mental health and awareness. Do you think that's something that should be taught even earlier? Like not even in just college, because if I'm correct, aren't you teaching courses on domestic violence?
Yeah, and child abuse.
And child abuse in UTSA, correct?
At UTSA, and it's a great class. I started teaching it a couple of years ago. It'll be 2 years now in January. Our first class was 35 on a Saturday. That was in the spring. And then in the fall, we had 45. Then the following spring, we had 65. And this fall, we have 85. And last semester, the class, I got an award for innovative teaching and service to undergrad students. It's the Howe Award at UTSA. And yeah, so I was, that's probably, you know, one of the most, I was excited to get that award. It means a lot. Yeah. To be an adjunct professor and be given that distinction by the University of Texas in San Antonio. In regard to education, let me just say that one of the goals of this class is to give new graduates that want to be caseworkers, want to be in law enforcement, want to work in social services as case managers, want to be in a helping profession, to at least get a leg up on what type of crimes they'll be dealing with, what type of population to be prepared for. Part of the class structure is we have live panels of judges, of attorneys, of advocates, of survivors, and they come and talk to the students about what the expectations are as a consumer, someone who's in the throes of domestic violence or in the CPS system, who needs guidance and who needs resources, or as a professional, whether you be a school counselor or you be a caseworker at CPS, or maybe you're an advocate against domestic violence, but that you have some semblance of navigating the resources system so you can get your client the resources they need. And they really like it in their feedback, which they give, you know, as part of their survey every semester, that they get to talk to actual judges and actual prosecutors, actual attorneys, actual survivors, actual advocates doing the work in our community to try and lift the stain of violence from our community.
Oh, that's good. Because if I'm correct, I heard Texas, as far as domestic violence, drug charges, and child abuse is number one.
If it's not, I'm sure it's pretty close.
And it's a very serious issue.
Oh, definitely. Very serious issue.
So why a judge?
You know, I think it's just a progression of having the ability to change people's lives for the better. Working in the social fields, I had many opportunities to help youth, to help parents, to help families from a caseworker perspective, from someone that was hands-on working in the community with them, whether that was as an instructor or a caseworker, a teacher, and that progressed to being an advocate in the courts for them. And that was as an attorney. And now the control that we can have over an individual in trying to force them to be accountable, number one, and making sure that our community is safe and Third, it's a triage approach, trying to do and support any effort to rehabilitate this individual so they can once again join our society and become productive members alongside us, as opposed to having to be locked up in a facility where you sleep on a steel bunk and have an aluminum toilet and sleep behind a set of bars every night.
Have you thought of even like becoming a mayor?
No, that's a different type of political effort, I think. For that type of position, you know, it's a very, very difficult position, because as mayor, you're a mayor of everyone in your city, you know, and you cannot, I guess, ignore the voice, but you have a lot more latitude to have a specific agenda of whatever projects you want to get done while you're mayor. And you can't do that without you having good relationships with your council and your city manager and your law enforcement and, you know, public services. You know, it takes a lot of balance. It takes a lot of reaching across the table. And so it's a lot of hard work, and it's 24/7. Am I saying that it's different from being a judge? Well, yeah. I mean, I deal with a very narrow slice of our society and population, those that end up in the court, those with that type of criminal problem. Whereas the mayor has to deal with everyone. You know, whether they're having a good day or not, he always has to have a good day. Or she, you know, whenever that happens, and it will happen. You know, we've had female mayors before. It'll happen again, hopefully sooner than later.
I love it.
So the mayor always has to have a good day. Anybody under that kind of spotlight and microscope, public microscope, I think is a huge, they have that huge burden, which is they cannot afford to have a bad day because it may be detrimental to the best interests of the people of San Antonio, you know?
Can I ask something?
Absolutely.
So why is it that your position, you have to be voted in versus like Judge Montemayor and Garcia that are appointed? Because your position is so important. So why is it like that?
Well, Judge Montemayor and Judge Garcia are associate master judges. Those are positions that were created by the district courts and commissioner's court to handle a huge influx of a specific type of case. Now, before Peter ran for his position, he was the only master judge who heard CPS cases. Richard Garcia was an associate master judge, and he did overflow from all the district courts. When Peter had to step down because he was running for judge, they had to fill Peter's spot. And Chuck Montemayor applied. It wasn't too much time later, after he was selected, that it became evident that it was a huge caseload. And so they created the second CPS master judge position to help Charles and have two courts running at once. And Richard Garcia was appointed to that position. Now, that left Richard Garcia's associate judge position open, and it hasn't been filled, and I don't think it hasn't been funded since he left. And they serve at the leisure of the district court judges. Okay. So I don't know if you were ever there early in the mornings when they have those dockets, but sometimes they would send cases from presiding that had nothing to do with CPS cases because they serve the district court judges.
Your court doesn't, or how does it?
What my court is an independent court, and there's 15 of us, but 13 and 7 handle almost exclusively domestic violence, if not exclusively domestic violence. Pre-COVID, and I've only done it a handful of times since COVID, I've covered cases when they have a lot of work over there and it looks like, you know, they're not going to get done till after 5. Sometimes they'll call, or I'll call if it's real slow for me. Do you have any cases? Do you want me to help you out, make it easier on them? So I do help the CPS docket when I feel like, you know, I got the time to do it and dedicate the time to it. Or if they call and they pre-schedule an afternoon, like maybe one of the judges is going to be at a training, they'll call me. And Judge Melissa Vada, I think, also does it as well. So we enjoy that docket. We think we make a difference there.
Who oversees the Reflejo Court?
I do.
Oh, yes.
Is that one of the programs that you created, the Reflejo?
The Reflejo Court was created pursuant to House Bill 3529. And that was a bill that me and my wife, Stacy Speedland Gonzalez, drafted on a few days' notice from Representative at the time, State Rep. Roland Gutierrez. And we wrote a bill that would, in effect, and it did, create a specialty court in County Court at Law 13 for violent offenders. And the House passed it unanimously, and it went to the Senate. The Senate had a hearing on it and then recommended it and put the bill on the governor's desk. And then the governor took a little bit of time, but I think it was in June of 2019. The governor did sign that bill into law. In other words, he legally created that Reflejo Court in County Court 13, specifically for violent offenders with some history of substance abuse, to see if we could not get this program up and going to address their behavior and hopefully affect their recidivism rate and make a difference, at least in the lives of them and their families. Really.
there's corruption everywhere. There's corruption everywhere. So like being in your position, has there ever been a time where you wanted to step down as a judge?
No.
When you questioned your position?
I've only been on the bench, it'll be 2 years in January. And it's been an honor. It's been, I'm a workaholic. You talk to any judge that has ever had to work to put food on the table before becoming a judge as an attorney. We were at work at 7:30 in the morning, ready to be in court by 8:30. I would see my last client at 8 o'clock at night. I wouldn't make it home until 10 o'clock at night. And this was every day. I was lucky if I could give myself a Friday and a Saturday night off. So a work ethic is not something that I don't think is lacking with our class of judges. We have a lot of judges that were in solo practice and appreciate a hard day's work. And we all have the hearts of servants. We also have the hearts of a lion. And so we're ready to tackle. You know, Yolanda Huff, one of my counterparts, Judge Huff, has the mental health court that she presides over. Judge Tommy Stolhansky presides over the adult drug court. Judge Helen Petrie Stowe presides over the DWI specialty court. Judge Mary Roman assists me and Judge Michael DeLeon with the domestic violence cases. You know, Melissa Vada will assist with the CPS cases. And everyone, you know, takes a turn whenever there's an opportunity to help a particular type of specialty court or, you know, exclusivity court like that. So no, I never thought about quitting in the 2 years. I don't think any of my counterparts have either.
Gotta keep it strong. Whenever you're in court, is there ever a time where sometimes your emotions just get the best of you and you just...
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I have to check myself because, you know, when I was an attorney, I had, you know, anywhere between 2 to 3 staff at all times. You know, coincidentally, they were all women. And, you know, I would come back from court and they'd have, you know, the chisme and the report on the client that was so difficult with them or was acting crazy at the office or, you know, screamed at them on the phone. And I would say to them, how many of you here have an open court case in court? And they'd all look at me like, none of us. I said, exactly. I said, because you all have the resources and the wherewithal to take care of your business. And you don't let it get so bad that you end up in court. These folks that have hired me to help them in court have issues that they weren't able to handle. You know, they, you know, for whatever reason, you know, life dealt them a bad hand, or they have mental health issues, or they have addiction, or there's violence or personality disorders, or it just didn't work out, or, you know, they're in the wrong place at the wrong time. And so, you know, we have to be, you know, sympathetic to that, and we have to be empathetic to that and remind ourselves that, but for the grace of God, there go I, right? So, you know, I often had to remind my staff of that. And even now, you know, I have to remind myself as a judge, a left turn here and then a right turn over there, I could have been right where they're at right now. And but for decisions I made at the crossroads in my life, thank God, you know, I made the right decisions and that's where I am right now.
How does it feel just coming home when you're leaving the courtroom? I bet it's like the best feeling ever, seeing your kids and everything.
I love being home. During COVID, you know, I think we all dabbled in things, either cooking or finding, you know, books to read or, you know, karaoke.
Your mosaics.
My mosaics, yeah. So I discovered the art of mosaics. And I'm very thankful and appreciative of Stacy's mother, retired Judge Phyllis Speedland Weatherman, because she invited us, and she's invited us to these classes taught by just a very talented artist, instructor, jeweler, Susan Butler. And all the magic happens in her house, at least the instruction. She's taught us the art of making mosaics from cutting glass to color combinations and inspiring our imagination and our creativity. And I've got my garage all set up now where I've done, you know, pieces for friends and gotten more ambitious with it. And I'm pretty pleased with the stuff. Taught my friends how to do it. And so it's a great pastime. It's very therapeutic. I can see how it could be deemed occupational therapy. So
I have to have fun. You know, you really have to. When the court, when they asked you to take off your flag, the pride flag, how did that make you feel?
You know, there was a mindfulness to putting it up in the first place. Yep. That flag was presented to me by the Orgullo Council of LULAC. Maria Salazar, a colleague of mine, another CPS attorney, presented it to me at my swearing in. It had meaning to it because I was one of the founding members of Orgullo LULAC Council, and it was the second LGBT LULAC Council in the state of Texas. I put it up in the courtroom because the flag is a symbol of equality for all people. And you know, it got reported as me showing a bias toward gay people, LGBT people. At the same time, there was another complaint filed simultaneously almost for me congratulating attorneys on social media after they won the case for their client, regardless of whether it was a prosecutor or it was a private counsel. And so it so happened that the period that they looked at, there were 12 guilties and 12 not guilties. I was told that that was improper and that I should not be doing that because it compromised my ability to be fair.
Yeah.
And so I was ordered to do 4 additional hours of training and a reprimand that could affect my ability to work as a visiting judge. And so because of those reasons, my attorney and I felt that we needed to appeal the decision. And it's on the appeal, in the appeal process right now. It will go before another 3-member board of Court of Appeals judges, justices, and they will review whether the punishment was appropriate and if it was appropriate, whether it was punitive and whether they're going to change the ruling from the lower board or whether they're going to affirm it. And that will happen as soon as we can get an in-person hearing.
Well, just know I'm rooting for you, Judge Rosen.
Okay, thank you.
I think before every court case, everyone should do that Wim Hof breathing for one round, you know, calm the room
down.
Calm everybody down.
But the flag is posted right at my chamber door next to the American flag. So when you come into our office and you come into my chambers, the flags are right there. I was ordered to remove it from the courtroom along with every other rainbow that was being shown in the courtroom. So that's the other part of the ruling that we're appealing.
And that courtroom is your courtroom.
No, that courtroom belongs to the people of Bexar County. I just happen to preside over that court. I am the holder of the key. I'm entrusted with ensuring that justice is doled out to anybody who seeks it in that court.
There was a movie I saw. I don't know if you've seen it, Hateful Eight.
The Hateful Eight?
Yeah. Quentin Tarantino, one of his movies.
No, I'm not a big Quentin Tarantino fan.
Nah, that's okay.
It's a little too gory for me.
That's okay. I like it. But there was a line that this person said, and he talks about how him being an executioner, he can't feel any remorse towards the people. So for you, I'm not saying you're an executioner, obviously you're a judge, but when you make those decisions that you make, how does that impact you inside?
You know, I put thought into the decisions. Some decisions are easier than others based on the evidence presented. I have to be resolved in those decisions. I can't be second guessing myself, and it's going to be the decision that I make. And if there's ramifications to that, whether there's an appeal or someone gets hurt, God forbid, but it's inevitable, then I'll have to deal with that. We're doing our best to ensure not only that the accused is guaranteed due process and that they are seen in the eyes of the court as innocent until proven guilty, but also in protecting the complaining witness who, at the end of the course of this case running, will either be a victim, survivor, or just another complaining witness that, you know, whose case was dismissed. And so for that part of the two-sided argument, I have to be able to make decisions that keep them safe. On the other side of that coin is the defendant with constitutional guarantees, with the right to due process. And in many cases, I'm not saying all, but several, you know, there's some falsity to some of the accusations. So oftentimes I have to talk to the defendant and say, look, when I create space between you and the complaining witness, it could very well to spare you from these continued lies that you allege are being cast against you. If it's not true, why would you want to be close to someone who's lying about you? So my orders tend to kind of attack it on all sorts of different levels. And I try to keep it balanced, always keeping at the forefront, minimizing any harm to anyone involved in the case.
I like that. One of the last questions I wanted to ask you before we close out this podcast, what else are you looking to reform here in San Antonio? What is something you would like to fix?
Always, I think, with the way our government works is allocation of resources. One of the things that I will always hope for is that those county elected officials that hold the purse strings to funding for CPS courts, for all the specialty courts that address the problem in the behavior of the defendants, of the respondents, of the participants, that they be funded sufficiently to make them effective. When you cut funding, it holds all those people hostage. And we have to cut resources, we have to cut personnel. And when you do that, then service provision suffers. And the families and children, the victims, the perpetrators, the violent people, the actors, they are deprived of an opportunity to be safe, to be able to sleep at night, not worrying that something else is going to happen to them. They're deprived of an opportunity to argue their case, their access to justice. They're deprived of an opportunity to maybe redeem themselves through accountability. Because for those individuals that come before the court that say, mea culpa, I did it, we want to offer them an opportunity to redeem themselves as well. This is not a case where there's the death penalty or a court where there's a death penalty or you're sent to prison for life. This is a misdemeanor court. This is the early stages of the criminal behavior, alleged criminal behavior. And we have a huge opportunity at this level to correct behavior, to bring the behavior back in line with social expectations and what's been defined as legal and not legal. So the more that we can fund the ways in which we helped or we help people self-correct or correct with our help, through coercive measures, the most extreme being incarceration, then I think the more we can help people.
If you think about it, humans are, they're the cause to all problems, but we can fix a lot of these problems. And if we could just help each other and benefit each other better, it's like a domino effect. We start taking care of our people, our family, our community, then we start taking care of the planet. But it really all starts with us and just taking care of humans. Mm-hmm. And I don't think people ever see that bigger picture where it's...
No, I think what we've seen, it's unfortunate, in just the last bundle of years is a deterioration of a united effort to make of my social contract with you, which is I'll take care of you because I know you'll take care of me. And instead what we're seeing more and more as of recent is I'm in my lane, stay out of my lane, and I'll stay out of your lane. And it's each man for themselves. And that is based on misrepresentations that lead to fear, unwarranted competitiveness, a need to feel superior to other people due to gender, due to race, a belief that there won't be enough for you. So you have to go out and fight tooth and nail for it. So I think we need to get back to a more fraternal, brotherly, sisterly, united community approach to things. It takes a village and it takes a while sometimes. But this kind of you raise buildings, you rape, you pillage, you burn because you're not getting what you want or you're on your way to get what you want doesn't work. That's so destructive, not only physically, but emotionally and spiritually. And it's a huge detriment to, this experiment we call our American democracy and how we interact with each other, not just here in San Antonio, but all of Central Texas, the whole state and, other states around the country and how we interact with the rest of the world. The internet has made the world a much smaller place. When I was a kid, my only connection to Radio Havana or the Filipino radio stations or the Russian was shortwave radio at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And I would sit there in my bed with my headphones on with the shortwave radio, trying to catch all the stations from around the world. Never in my wildest life at the age of 12 and 13 did I think we would have internet and I'd be able to have FaceTime with someone in Abu Dhabi or
Dubai.
Tokyo or,
China.
Somewhere in Argentina or China or Russia. We can do that right now.
Could do that right now.
And who would have thunk? And here we are. We have even the most remote connections can be so close. And that didn't exist before. And so I think, we've become a little bit more mindful of our responsibility to just other humans as opposed to just our neighbors across the street. But at the same time, all politics is local. What is important to us? That we're safe. So local law enforcement, right? That we are safe in our homes. Okay, fire department. That should something happen to us, we're safe. EMS. That we can get from one place to another without too many obstacles. We want streets and roads, that we can go somewhere to recreate and socialize. We want parks, that we can travel at night without fear of being accosted. We want streetlights. And so everything that affects those things I just listed is local politics. That's all about who's your city council person, who's your commissioner. And so even though we've created this huge connection through the internet, we can only live in so much space around us, right? So we're concerned with what's closest to us. That's our house, our yard, our block, our city, because that's really what affects our quality of life, right?
Exactly.
On a day-to-day basis.
As a city. What I've learned, especially this year, is for a moment, it's like, screw the national political, like who the president is. What's more important is who's running the city. That's more important.
How are we keeping our city safe from COVID, right? How are we keeping our numbers down? Are we encouraging our neighbors to wear their masks? How are we treating the folks that need our help at the hospitals? Well, right now we're even taking in El Paso folks, right? Because they're in such dire need.
Yeah, I'm from El Paso, so it's very heartbreaking.
To watch El Chuco like that, to starve for good oxygen to start for sanitation, you know, and clean air.
And you said it better. It really starts with the city and how are they taking care of their own people.
Mm-hmm.
As far as San Antonio, I would say we could be doing a better job, definitely. But, I mean, there's other places where it's crazy.
Yeah, we're not El Paso. But as you said, you know, there's always room for improvement. We can always be doing things better. I think that's the perpetual chasing the dragon of every city elected official. How can we do things better? You know, we definitely don't want to go backwards and we always want to go forwards in serving as many people as we can serve with the highest quality of service, right?
Absolutely. Couldn't have said it better. Well, Rosie, before we close this out, is there anything else you would like to say for the people?
Just as I keep saying, observe the three W's. Wear your mask, watch your space, and wash your hands.
I like that. Thank you so much, Rosie. It was a pleasure having you. And I hope you keep tearing it up in the court. And
el placer fue todo mío.
Qué bueno, qué bueno. Y que cuidamos el gente. Y eso es todo, cuidar al gente. Ándale pues. Gracias.
Chao.
And that is all, folks. Once again, I want to thank Judge Rosie Speedling Gonzalez for coming onto the podcast from Bexar County Court Number 13. I also want to thank NK Productions for making the awesome beats in my introduction and JC3 Studios for this awesome beat for my outro. And I want to thank everyone else for tuning in and listening to the podcast. See you guys next time.